All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. I am so excited to be recording with two queer icons. That's not a phrase you guys may hear very often. Two X-Men editors from the 90s who I got the lovely opportunity to meet in New York City at Terry Cavanaugh's wonderful party. Two gentlemen that I have followed for years and that I used to read the books with your names in them. So whenever I meet someone in person, it's always a delight. Welcome to Kelly Corvacy and to Jay Gardner on the show today. Kelly's someone I reached out to a couple of years ago now, and we've been chatting for quite some time. And Kelly, it was so lovely to meet you in person. And Jay, I know I knew your name when I met you in person. It was just like, oh, I didn't even know you were gay, which was such a delight. It was really fun to hang out with you both at the party. And thank you so much for coming on the show today. Let me have you both introduce yourselves. Let us know your name and pronouns, a little about where we might know you from. And I would love to, our intro question today is, tell me about your move to New York City, way back at the beginning of your editorial days, if you would. Let's begin with Kelly and then Jay.
Oh Lord. Okay. So Kelly Corvacy, my pronouns are he, him, and I'm, I guess, best known for my editorial skills back in Marvel from 1987 to 1998, mainly on the X-Men. When I was 18, I left Hershey, Pennsylvania, where I had been staying in a boarding school for 10 years, and I was desperate to get to the big city to basically get into the comic industry because I loved comics as a kid and there was really nothing to do in Hershey living on a farm. I would walk 2 miles to get to the nearest comic store, and that's all I did was read comics, draw comics, write comics. So I moved to New York City in 1983, and it took a couple years. I was taking classes with a man named Ken Landgraf. He put a posting up on a lamppost asking kids if they wanted to draw and work at Marvel or DC. And so every Saturday, I would end up paying $20 and spending the whole afternoon learning how to draw and ink. That was my thing that I was into. And then eventually, I had a friend who had a cousin who worked in the children's department of Marvel Comics. Her name was Lillian Lovett. And he set up a meeting with me and went in there and showed them my artwork. She said, oh, wow, I can see you're very dedicated and you're really into this, but I have no job for you. But let me send you off to the Prime editorial department and see what they have. So I went upstairs and had a meeting with the assistant to Tom DeFalco. And she also said, well, I have no jobs for you. However, we'll keep your number. And then about a month later, I got a phone call and they had a position open. And so I started as the assistant to the assistant of Tom DeFalco, the editor-in-chief at the time.
That's giving very assistant to the regional manager, Dwight from the office.
Yeah, and I was just happy to be there. And I was the only gay person that anybody knew of at the time. I would say it took about 3 weeks. Like, I didn't announce that, hey, I'm gay, I'm here, and I'm going to start a revolution. You know, I just was there being myself. And I used to hang out with Chris Aurelia. She was the secretary to John Romita Sr. And my office was right outside of John. Well, my cubicle, my cubicle area was right outside of John Romita Sr.'s office. So Christine and I used to hang out a lot. And I got inker named Chris Ivey, who you probably know from his career. And we used to hang out and have lunch. And one day, I guess it was my coming out moment, he had a crush on a girl who worked upstairs, and she and I were hanging out a lot. And he thought I was a little bit of competition. So he then asked me, you know, if she's interested in you, you know, what's the deal? Are you interested in her? And I said, well, if she had a brother, maybe. So that was like I remember that was the first time I actually verbally kind of let it be known that I was gay, even though I didn't hide it. If anybody asked me anything, I of course would, you know, engage them. And he was like, oh, great. He was thrilled. And then from there, you know, that was my coming out moment.
Let me also welcome the incredible Jay Gardner to the show. Jay, welcome to Grey Milk and Lane.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. It's good to see you. Tell everybody a little of your origin story, if you would.
So I was at Marvel from, my first internship was in the summer of 90. And then I was at Marvel from like 91 to 98. So I started a few years after Kelly, but I had been reading comics since I was a young kid, probably at the age of 11 was when I first started picking up comics. I started with the familiars, so like Legion of Superheroes, all that DC, Justice League comics, because that's what I watched as a kid, was the Super Friends. And then I came across a comic that had, it was called Dazzler, number 6. And the Hulk was smashing through her stage as she was performing. And I thought, how can one woman stand against the Hulk? Because I had seen the Hulk TV show. So I picked that comic up. I read it front to back, and it was a two-parter. So I couldn't wait to get the second part. And then a friend of mine said, well, Dazzler's a mutant, so you should like read this other book called Uncanny X-Men. So the first issue of that I picked up was 150, which was a big double-sized Magneto issue. Mm-hmm. Dave Cockrum, Chris Claremont, very traditional X-Men comic, very famous comic. And I was hooked on X-Men then after that. And I kind of stopped reading DC and just started going with Marvel. But collected Dazzler, X-Men, all mutants. The age of 13, I thought, I would love to write stories for that. Didn't tell anybody. And I'm from Erie, Pennsylvania. So it wasn't until I had gone off to college, Clarion University of Pennsylvania, and I was in my sophomore year, and I came across this business almanac in the library at college. And it had basically every single company and their phone number in this almanac. And I thought, I wonder if Marvel has a phone number I can call. So I called the phone number. I reached the receptionist, who was probably Erica at the time. I can't remember Erica's last name. Kelly, you might remember Erica's last
name. Erica Mitchell.
Erica Mitchell. So I called the receptionist and she's like, oh, you need to talk to Suzanne Gaffney. She's in charge of our internships. And I thought, oh, wow, they have internships. So I had about a 10-minute conversation with Suzanne Gaffney. She's like, type up a resume, send it to me, and you can probably do an internship with one of the editors that, you know, we have on staff. So she gave me the ins and outs of that. I did that. And next thing I knew, I was getting a phone call from Don Daly, who was the editor of The Punisher. And I had no idea about The Punisher. Was the first thing from my radar. So I kind of just had a great conversation with him though for, I don't know, he talked to me for about a half hour or so. And I just had never been to New York City, didn't know anything what it was going to be like. I can only imagine.
Now, were you out before you moved to the city, Jay?
No, not at all. So then my father drove me to New York. I had an interview with, you know, Suzanne Gaffney and met Don Daly and got a tour of Marvel. And Don said, you're going to be my intern. So after that, I was here in the summer of 1990. And did my full internship and met everybody on staff. And that was the start of my career. And I forgot to give you my pronouns. My pronouns are he, him.
Oh, goodness. I love these stories. Two queer small town Pennsylvania boys moving to the big city. One of them because he read a pop star fighting against an angry white guy. That makes me happy. Now, I'm just going to kind of jump all over your careers a little bit and ask some more blanket questions. I know you guys were working in the office around the same time. And we're going to start in a relatively serious space. As you were starting to come out in the early 90s and live that queer life in New York City, it's the AIDS crisis around the same time. And I know more and more people were coming into Marvel and being more outwardly queer. This is the era where we started to see a lot of queer protests and queer voices. The Real World on MTV, you know, a few years later really pushes that to another level. I know there were a lot of queer people working. What was it like to work at Marvel being out and queer, even in a private way through this era of storytelling, where there's so much queer subtext happening in the X-Men comics and others, even as Chris Claremont's leaving the book and this kind of new generation of writers and the animated series is coming in. So a lot of things happening creatively and culturally all at the same time. Let's go Jay and then Kelly on this one.
Well, I'd say, I think there were only two editors who were out that I knew of at the time, and one was Kelly and one was Chris Cooper. But I felt very accepted, even though I hadn't come out to anybody at the beginning. beginning, and this was probably during my first internship. And then I probably revealed to Kelly and Chris that I was gay. It was just normal, like, for them. They're like, oh, don't worry about anybody. You know, everybody's like very accepting here. So it was just strange for me to not have to worry about hiding who I was or anything. And I think maybe initially I tried to the first couple months I was there, but it just felt normal to actually be able to be yourself. So I found that very like a thriving environment, you know, to be yourself and not hide who you are. So
yeah,
so that was very encouraging for me because I'd never experienced that before. And then actually I had to go back and finish my senior year, and I was invited back for a second internship, and I did that with Kelly and Terry Cavanaugh.
Fast forward a few years. In 2008, yeah. I'm working for the Marvel Handbooks, and I have a profile of myself printed in the back of an X-Men handbook that talks about me being straight and Mormon.
Oh, really?
Just a few years later, everything changed. Kelly, what was same question for you, my friend?
It was a lot different for me because when I started, of course, there were no gay people there as far as I knew. It was probably about 2 years in, someone had introduced me to Chris Cooper at my gym, and they said, hey, you work at Marvel. Oh my God, do you know Chris? And I'm like, no. And so they introduced us. And as Chris and I were talking, he was like, oh my God, you got the greatest job. I want to work at Marvel one day. And I said, well, I'll let you know if anything comes available. And, you know, shortly after, I did let him know about a job opening. I think it was with Bob Budansky on Transformers. I could be wrong, but the way Chris wrote a book about his life, because this is the same Chris Cooper that had that incident in the park with the crazy woman.
With the white woman who called the cops on the guy because he told her to put a dog on a leash. Yeah, that was crazy. Yeah.
So in Chris's book, he writes, you can actually pick it up and read it, exactly, you know, who he worked for there. But he was the only other person besides me at that point for, again, another couple of years. But he was very out. And as you'll see, if you pick up any swimsuit issue that he worked on, he made it 50-50. It was usually lots of swimsuit shot of the female characters, but he made it half men and half women. And we're talking bikinis.
We've featured some of those images in various places on this show.
And then, of course, he, you know, North Star and Alpha Flight, you know, he really did a lot of writing and was instrumental in changing things at Marvel in that respect. Jay came along, and as I recall, it was just me, Jay, and Chris. There may have been somebody else in the closet, I'm not sure. But I do remember when Jay first started, he used to run around the bullpen with his pants cuffed. Do you remember this, Jay?
Yeah.
You had an interesting way of cuffing your pants. And I thought, that seems very gay. So I was clued into Jay possibly being gay at that point. And then, of course, we started talking, and it all was revealed. So it was the three of us for a while. Then a few more people started after that. But in the beginning, I mean, I remember Bob Harris having to chastise one of my writers who was a good friend of mine and who could joke with me about gay stuff. Kind of, you know, not make fun of me, but it was all in good fun. And I didn't mind it at the time. But Bob Harris had said to him, you can't do that anymore. You're treading on thin water. Don't say things like that about Kelly. And he's like, oh, but he's my friend. He doesn't care. Da, da, da. He goes, no. And so when it got back to me, I was like, ooh, okay.
I don't recall that at all, Kelly.
I'll tell you later who it was, who the freelancer was. But, you know, Bob just didn't want me to go to, there was a danger of going to HR and all that. But that would have never happened in my end, because at that point, I was a big boy. I could take care of myself.
Yeah. I just remember everybody embracing me. There was no one batted an eye when I actually finally told people I was gay and stuff. They were all very accepting. And maybe that's the nature of New York City at the time, but I'd been so terrified to come out as a kid. I remember, honestly, I can remember going to kindergarten. How old are you then? 5, mm-hmm. You know? And I remember like walking in the very first day with my mom, holding my hand, and I wanted to find like the cutest boy to sit next to become his friend. So nothing sexual or anything like that, but just being attracted to whoever the cutest boy was in my mind. And I became friends with that kid. I sat next to him. But I remember like feelings as young as kindergarten, being attracted to boys.
And same for me. I was 5. And, you know, if it's a little straight kid sitting next to a little straight girl, we're like, oh, how cute. But when it's a gay kid, even as adults, we feel like we have to clarify, you know?
Yeah.
It's a crazy thing. Now, around the same time you guys were working on the books, the animated series really pushed the X-Men into new levels of popularity for a new generation. I know Claremont had the book and that like monopoly for so many years, but the X-Men changed the industry. And then that cartoon seemed to change the X-Men and the industry itself. Do you remember, and I know there was even that X-Men Adventures book you were putting out, the adaptation of the cartoon, but do you guys remember what it was like to try to match the books toward the cartoon and like what sort of pressure was put there? I know even the movies were happening around the same time as well.
Well, funny enough, enough, Bob Harris. So one of the things that I really knew was from X-Men 94 on, I knew the continuity pretty well. And I had, as a kid, I had collected all the back issues. So Bob Harris really sort of came to rely on me as, and at that time I was Kelly's assistant editor on continuity for the X-Men. And when the writers, the X-Men animated show, were looking for material, Bob would come to me and say, do you know any stories about Storm where she had a solo story or anything like that that they could pull from? And I was like, yeah, actually Life Death, you know? And so I pulled Life Death, made photocopies, they sent them to the writers, and they came up with that storyline where Storm has a quote unquote son in Africa. They did a whole episode of that, but that really came from
Ms. Nari. I remember Ms. Nari.
Yeah. So that all came from, you know, Bob asking me, you know, like, what should they do? You know, so from that point on, Bob actually had me read the scripts, make suggestions and stuff. And they were pretty on point. I don't really recall having many revisions because they really did their due diligence in reading anything that we gave them.
Kelly, any thoughts there?
Well, I do recall working on X-Men Adventures, the comic version of the cartoon. I remember being very proud of it. And even though it was the lexicon of the main X books, it was fun doing it because everyone was so into the cartoon. And then we got to do the actual comic book version of it. I remember really enjoying copying the storylines, and it was actually quite easy because they were all written already. I didn't have to actually hire a writer except for, you know, balloon placement and that kind of thing. So I remember it being a lot of fun.
Did you guys watch X-Men 97?
Oh, yeah.
It's phenomenal, right? Like, such a great continuity moment for us, I think even as queer creators.
Okay. At one point, we had, Jay, you remember this, I wrote lyrics to the X-Men theme song at a Christmas party, or maybe Stan Lee was at Marvel. I don't remember where he was, but someone said I should just go up to him and start singing a lyric that I had written. I don't know, you know, what that meant. They're like, I was going to actually get them on the show, but it was quite fun.
So rewind a couple years ago, I am in my mid-40s. I am making this show. I have a husband and two kids, and we're recording a Christmas episode for the people to listen to. And I pop open Marvel Holiday Special 1991. This is the content we used for the episode. And I found that old page that I hadn't seen in years of Christmas carols that were adapted by like the X-Men, or the Christmas carols with like X-Men words. I ended up performing the Vogue Rogue song. And right at the bottom, it says written by Kelly Corvacy, which then I Googled you. And that's when I learned you were gay. And then I started like putting the pieces of your career together. And I'm like, of course he's gay. This is the guy that created Adrenazon. From Marvel Comics Presents, who's the gayest version of She-Hulk ever.
It was. And if you actually pay attention to the storyline of how Adrenazon came to be, you'll see remnants of Lindsay Wagner, the Bionic Woman, who is just my hero of any actress ever. It was an homage to a storyline that they had done on that TV series.
I play this weird game. So I have ADHD, and whenever I have to sit through like long meetings, I'll bring a notebook and I'll just kind of write lists of things. I'll write an alphabetized list of every city I can think of or comic characters. And forever, when I do this quite often, it keeps my brain focused. But whenever I have the letter A in my brain, the two characters that will auto-populate on my list are Adrenazon and Anaconda, who are both...
Oh, boy.
Queer, which is a weird thing. She lives in my brain for that reason.
I'd be a team up.
That'd be a great team up. They could go on a date. It'd be great. Kelly, you got to explore a lot of your kind of creative side when you were doing editing. I see a lot of you writing for What The, or these little stories in the backs of various magazines, or even writing these like Christmas Carol parodies. It's really fun to see you like use that creative side in your editing style. Do you want to give voice to that a little bit about what that was like for you at the time?
Sure. Well, I have to go back. When I was a kid, I created my own comics, of course, and I didn't even know what an editor was. But at the bottom of the comic, the first page, just like they did in DC and Marvel, I would write Kelly Corvacy writer, Kelly Corvacy editor, Kelly Corvacy inker. You know, it was all my credits at the bottom. So I had interest in all of it. Working at Marvel, I wanted to do as much as I could. I wasn't quite as good a penciler as I thought I was once I got into the industry. So being an editor, you got to do a little bit of everything, and you got to be surrounded by such creative people. And that's probably the biggest thing I miss at Marvel, not being at Marvel anymore, is just being around creative writers and artists. That's was like the best part of it. And there was a time, I believe it was with Howard Mackey and Todd DeZago. They were two writers who worked on X Factor. And when we worked together creating stories, it was probably my most creative years. I would say that was between 93 and 90. Yeah, I remember that as being my most creative moment.
Jay, do you ever recall getting lost in the continuity of things? Like a storyline that perhaps you worked on that you were like, oh no, we're doing this. One that comes to mind is Madeline Pryor romancing Nate Gray in X-Man. Do you have any moments that live in your brain as like, oh wow?
No, I was all for that. I do recall Bob Harris coming into my office, though. This is after I was Kelly's assistant. I had gotten promoted to what they called an associate editor, which is like a managing editor. So you don't really, you share an assistant, you don't have your own assistant, and you don't have as many titles as that you're editing as a regular editor would. So I had inherited X-Man coming out of the Age of Apocalypse. When X-Man came over from the Age of Apocalypse into the Marvel Universe, he was in sort of dire straits and mentally agonizing over everything he had been through during the Age of Apocalypse and was reaching out for comfort. And at that point, he kind of started thinking about his mother, who was Jean Grey in that universe, who showed up at Madeline Pryor. He manifested her whole and, you know, three-dimensional, fully formed being. And that's how Madeline came back to life after having been gone for so many years, you know, dead. So I was thrilled to get that storyline because Madeline was one of my favorite characters, actually, from when I was a kid reading her and everything she had gone through with being the Goblin Queen and all that. So I was so familiar with it that we really encouraged that storyline throughout X-Man until we were encouraged not to do that storyline anymore. And I was upset to give that up. But anyhow, so there was one point where Bob came into my office to say, really? And what happened was Nate was sort of thinking about his mother again. He was with another character named Threnody.
We love Threnody.
With Threnody. And he started thinking of it. And then the next thing you know, like there next to him, she leans in and kisses him on the lips. And this is essentially his mother, but it was all in his imagination. And it was Threnody kissing him. So, and I'm like, well, Bob, didn't you ever hear of Oedipus? You know, like it's a classic Shakespearean experience, you know, to be in love with your mother and all that. So anyhow, I got chastised for having that in the comic, but it was already printed and everything. So there's nothing he could do.
And boy, did that become a storyline. We did a Patreon episode on this character recently.
Oh, did you?
It was a lot of fun. Yeah, I'll share it with you when it comes out. Actually, it's out. I'll send you a link. It's a good time. There was also, taking it back to the Age of Apocalypse, when the Age of Apocalypse ended, of course, it's very beloved. And there's that conversation where you want to bring some of those characters back into the real world. We ended up with Holocaust, Sugar Man, the Dark Beast, and X-Man. How did you land on those four? And were there any other characters that like almost made the cut?
I remember kind of Bob sort of informing us of that. I don't know if I was necessarily at that time, because coming out of that was when I got promoted to associate editor. So I was only an assistant editor. And I don't think I was privy to those conversations. I think I was more informed about them. I don't know if Kelly was part of that or not.
I seem to remember an Age of Apocalypse group meeting with all the editors. I just don't have details for you.
No, that's okay. Long
ago. It was a while ago. Yeah.
I
remember those. We used to have those conferences every year for like the big X-Men crossover. Those were always thrilling, you know, to have all the writers there and even artists they started sending to these big conferences and just powwowing over, you know, where to take the stage.
What were some of your favorite maxi crossovers to work on for both of you? Because those could be such a huge headache when you're coordinating so many teams.
Well, definitely Age of Apocalypse. I'm trying to think of the others.
Well, the one I didn't like at all was Phalanx Covenant.
Right. I agree.
Why?
I wish I could tell you why. I just remember it was the main character there that who was that, Jay?
There was the technovirus that was like infecting everybody.
Because it was virus and this, and it wasn't visually exciting to me. I don't know. I wasn't into that one.
I would agree with that. I think Age of Apocalypse was the most exciting. But the other one that was really fun was Fatal Attractions. And that was Peter David threw out this joke in the middle of Peter David was our writer on X Factor for Kelly and I. Threw out a joke about Magneto just all of a sudden ripping out the adamantium from Wolverine's body. And it was a joke. It was a pure on 100% joke. And when he said it, everybody just went silent. Like, that would be really fucking cool.
Well, and then that design with like no-nose feral Wolverine with the bandana came back, which is another crazy thing from this era.
And him having the bone claws, nobody had thought of that before, you know, like that, because everybody always thought that the claws were, you know, part of the adamantium that was built into his body. But it was just really fascinating that all that came from one joke.
Yeah. Kelly, tell me about launching X-Men Unlimited, another thing that came out of this era that was such a transformative book for so many fans.
Oh, it really was. The quarterly. Oh, those were so much work. Because we had, I think it was what, well, quarterly, it was 4 months. You had to come up with these gigantic, what was it, 68 pages or?
64 and no ads. Four.
The first one we did, X-Men Unlimited, had Joe Madureira as the artist.
Nope.
No?
Uh-uh.
Who was it?
So it was initially Cary Gamble, and we were going with him, and he was sort of slow in turning in the pages, but they looked amazing, but we were getting thrown off on our deadlines.
And it was Chris Bacalo, the first time, with the X-Men and the artist and Sienna Blaze. Yeah.
And it was a focus of Storm. It was like three of them, Storm, Cyclops, and...
And Jean Grey, yeah.
Yeah.
Xavier's lying in a frozen wasteland and Magneto finds him and nurses him back to health.
They remind me, isn't that the issue that was supposed to go to John Romita Jr. initially?
Possibly, and then it had to be pushed back. I think that had to go back.
Because he was working on something else at the time, and I remember he was running late.
Yeah. No, that was Cary Gamble was the original artist, and he was running late, and we ended up getting Chris Pachalo to take over the book.
So what made those books such a headache? Just the sheer size and coordination?
Yeah, and the timing. Because you can work with a writer on a monthly book, and you kind of have it planned out what's going to happen in the next 6 months to a year. But with the quarterly, you have to come up with, you know, something that has to be a big storyline because it's a special issue and it's out of the blue. And you have to create an entire team, writer, artist, and all, you know. And so that takes a lot of time and energy to fit it into a schedule and get it done. And then the minute you're finished, you got to start the next one.
Yeah, yeah. Massive. Jay, when you were working on the Punisher books, there's a weird era in the mid-90s where Punisher kind of became an X-Men book for a minute. Like the Mutant Liberation Front and the Executioner and all these X-Men characters start weaving in and out. How did that happen? I that's one of the weirder corners of the X-Men universe that I find.
You're not going to believe this, but I really don't remember the
Punisher. No, that's okay.
So, and I took over, I want to say Punisher 2099 as well. Like, so Marvel had gone through bankruptcy in the middle of the 90s. I don't know if you've ever talked about that with
me. Yes.
And Kelly and I, you know, we had survived several downsizings, but every time there was a downsizing, everybody's workload would kind of double because whoever the editors were that were let go, those books still had to be published until they were, you know, ended. So I think during that time, there was just so much that we had received that we had to take up that slack. I don't recall all of the Punisher issues that I worked on. I remember I had, I want to say Tom Lyle, I think, as the artist. It was like Punisher and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or or maybe it was just Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. at that time. But I don't really remember the storylines or anything because it was a rather overwhelming time. And it was just a few issues and then they finally ended those, you know, those titles.
Another crazy editorial decision made at the time was the launching of the character Joseph, the clone of Magneto. Do you guys remember those conversations about Magneto's clone post Fatal Attractions?
I don't.
I don't either.
No, that's okay. Again, tossing some things at the wall. What would, if you think about it for a moment, what would you say one of the biggest impacts you personally had as an editor on the X-Men line? Is there like a storyline you helped particularly craft or a team you put together or a character you had a particular influence on?
I have to think about this for a minute. I should have done some research before we got on.
No, it's okay. And again, whatever shakes out here is fine. And if nothing, it's okay too.
Yeah, my favorite was probably working on X-Men. I really enjoyed that time. That was like some of the proudest stuff I did. Another one that was surprisingly, it's not X-Men related, but Silver Surfer. I inherited Silver Surfer. One of the editors was let go. And at that time, Mark Gruenwald had passed away. Ron Garney had been hired to do the book prior to me taking...
Love Ron Garney's pencils.
And Mark DeMatteis, J.M. DeMatteis, was hired as the writer. And so...
I remember them doing crazy stuff with the Puppet Master in this era.
Yes. And so I was the editor of those. And interestingly, they just published a trade paperback, those issues, and the entire trade paperback are all ones that I edited. And I was like, it's kind of cool that there's no other editor in there other than me. But those are some of my favorite storylines as well. And Mark DeManis and Ron Garney really did some fabulous stuff with that. And we had planned out this whole, because it was also at the time when Image had formed, and Image, some of our characters went over to Image to publish for a year. So we had lost Fantastic Four, Captain America, the Avengers over to Image, and Hulk, I think. And not Hulk, David Banner, not the Hulk, but David Banner.
Right.
So the Hulk was still the Hulk, but he just had no recollection of David Banner. And then like Silver Surfer came back to Earth, but he had no recollection of any of the Fantastic Four or the Avengers or anything like that. So his memory was kind of fuzzy at the time. And so we encountered like the Hulk and Doctor Strange and all that. We explored that whole storyline and the Puppet Master and Alicia Masters. And that's some of my favorite stuff as well. So the X-Men and Silver Surfer, I think, are two of my favorite, selections from my time editing.
Absolutely. And Kelly, for you?
Well, Chad, I was just going to say, now you see why Jay was such a great assistant to me, because there were so many things I couldn't remember. Did we hire that guy? Where did this character come from? And Jay just had right there. Because I was never, I was a DC fan. I was never a Marvel fan before I started at Marvel. I read a few, I read Dazzler, I read She-Hulk, all the girly, type books. But I never read X-Men at all before I started working on them. So everything I felt like a lot of times I was playing catch up. And Jay was very instrumental in helping with that, because he was a huge fan before he even started there. So.
I remember Larry Hama mentioning me on, he was on QVC selling something comic related. They asked him a question about continuity. He's like, oh, you have to talk to Jay Gardner. Yeah. This is on QVC. So my name was mentioned on QVC back then. And I thought it was the funniest thing that someone was saying my name on QVC. I don't know if you people know what QVC is.
Oh, of course. Of course. why did you both leave Marvel when you did?
Well, we left because of the bankruptcy. After about 2 years of surviving layoff, literally on the same day, I do remember Jay and I with boxes of our belongings walking out the back door.
So it was the fourth downsizing. We had survived three. I think they had an editorial staff, I want to say about 45 people between, editorial assistant editors, associate editors, editors, senior editors. On the day we left, the editorial staff had gone down to 16. And then on the day we left, they let six of us go. So they only had 10 people in editorial left on the day that we left. Mm-hmm. So, but we had endured all that for a couple of years. And it was very frustrating that when, I think it was Ron Perlman had owned Marvel at the time. He brought Marvel public.
Oh, I forgot Ron Perlman was involved. That's
yeah,
right.
And not Ron Perlman, the actor, Ron Perlman, the makeup Revlon owner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he had purchased Marvel. He brought Marvel public, took Marvel to new heights with the stock being on sale. Marvel had purchased a bunch of other companies rather quickly, and not a lot of them were very fruitous for them. They ended up shutting a lot of them down. I remember like Welsh Publishing, which is the children's publisher they bought. They ended up just shutting that down. They had bought a sticker company, and they also bought their own distributor. So they bought Heroes World, where comic books used to be distributed across six different companies, Diamond, Capital, Heroes World, and a couple other smaller ones across the country. And Heroes World was the smallest distributor. Marvel bought them because they were in New Jersey, and then funneled all their books through Heroes World, and they couldn't accommodate that whole massive market. So a lot of companies weren't getting comic stores weren't getting their comic.
Now, had the bankruptcy not happened, would you guys have stayed at Marvel for a long time, do you think?
I think I would have stayed there a lot longer, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I would have stayed there. Yeah.
Where did you end up after, or how did this downsizing kind of change your life?
Well, it changed, going to a place to work with colorful posters on the wall and reaching up to, children all over the world with storylines that you could, help them deal with coming out, because, of course, the X-Men being a mutant and relating it to being gay or trans or, different, not having that anymore was really sad.
Kelly, didn't you and Mark Gruenwald also work on Quasar together, and you introduced like a gay character into Quasar?
We did. I just don't recall much about Quasar, though, except for Greg being a great artist.
Do you remember who the gay character was?
I don't.
I remember it was a supporting character, and it was one of the first ones at Marvel.
Before Northstar?
Before Northstar came out.
Wow. I mean, I do remember Quasar, the sales were very low until Greg came along to be the artist.
Was it Greg Capullo?
People know about it, and I don't recall it.
We talk about Quasar from time to time. There's a lot of queer subtext. His girlfriend Kayla Ballantyne, right? Like, but I don't remember a queer supporting cast character. I'll have to do a brain scan, and we'll talk about it another time. Kelly, would you enjoy talking about your partner and the recent change that you've been through, or would you rather leave that off the show completely?
No, I could do that.
The reason being, I was rereading the issue today, and there's Charles Xavier in this period of grief.
That's what I'm about right now, so I can't avoid it if I'm being honest.
Yeah. So Kelly, I know when I first reached out to you to come on the show, you were very happily married and very much in love. And I know your partner was going through a lot of changes. Do you want to talk a little bit about the journey you've been on the last couple couple of years. My heart just reaches out to you so much, my friend.
Yeah, I'm sorry we never got together. It was almost 2 years ago when you first reached out. And David had cancer, he was diagnosed at stage 4 of the appendix, which is undetectable until it becomes stage 4 and you detect it in your liver or some other organ once it's spread. So we were quite shocked and devastated, of course. So I wasn't able to meet with you or have an interview earlier because I was just, you know, too emotional and too much to deal with. He passed on July 18th of this year. We moved up here. We have a country house in the Catskill Mountains. We moved up here in April because David wanted to just be up here in his final moments, which he got. He'd never wanted to be in a hospital. He really was able to face this bravely and with dignity. And so I was his primary caregiver, and we never ended up being in a hospital bed. So that was fantastic. I was able to take care of him right up to his last moments. And my life is now a complete blank slate. I retired. I moved up here, and I no longer have my husband. So rebuilding from scratch, which is...
How long were the two of you together?
We were together for 25 years.
Just an epic love story, my friend. Was David a comic book fan?
No, not at all. He
is... That's my husband too. He doesn't want to hear a word.
he would send me to the comic movies on my own. Although he did see Wonder Woman. He did see some, maybe the latest X-Men, but he really wasn't into it. But he appreciated it for what it was. And he enjoyed my history doing it. You know, he was very proud of what I accomplished in the industry. And he knew a few of my friends. He knew Jay, of course.
I think we all went and saw the second Black Panther together.
Was that it? Yeah. And he loved that movie. Yeah, he loved the Black Panther. So if it had some real character development and had a real theme, he enjoyed that. He just wasn't really into the history of comics or anything, and didn't ever translate it into movies for him.
Thank you for sharing a bit of your story for our listeners. I know you've been through a lot of change. When I got to meet you in person, it was such a thrill just to give you a big hug. And I could see you, I mean, you told me then, like, this is kind of my first foray back into the world after this kind of cycle of grief that I've been in.
Yeah, it was
oddly parallel to our issue today in a resonant way for Charles Xavier as we opened the issue. And I didn't realize that until I was rereading the comic book this morning.
Well, I didn't connect it to it at all until now that you said that. So something must be, you know, turned off in my brain.
Yeah. And Jay, you're also happily partnered as well, correct?
Yes.
I don't know if you want to talk about your love story at all.
Well, we met in 95, so it'll be almost 30 years.
Amazing.
Next year. And we didn't get married until 2012. And we got married here in the city. So we got married on a boat with the Statue of Liberty over our shoulder. One of our friends, you know, officiating. And Kelly got to be part of that too. So
yeah, it was fun.
Kelly was there for that. But yeah, we've been together a long time.
I love this friendship, and I love vibing with you both. I can't wait to hang out again in person. You're both just lovely, lovely. And thank you for sharing some of your stories. I know it's always crazy to be asked questions 30 years later. That's a problem I run into on this show regularly. They're like, Chad, I wrote that book 40 years ago.
Yeah, like some of that stuff with like The Punisher, I just don't remember. I know I worked on it, and my nephew even called me and said, I'm reading a book that you edited, you know, Punisher. And I'm like, I didn't realize that.
So, yeah, sometimes you got to reread stuff too. Yeah. In fact, that's kind of Annie Nesenti's policy. She's like, tell me what to read beforehand, because don't trust that I'll remember anything. So we opened the year. I've been doing the Silver Age on my show. I think you guys have listened to a handful of episodes. We've been doing the Silver Age on my show since the beginning. And this year in 2025, we're launching into the new era of comic books, beginning with Giant Size X-Men #1. This episode is going to come out on January 20th. And we're exploring Krakoa for a lot of reasons. For the episode, in fact, coming out immediately after this, is going to involve 4 incredible creators. And we're just, the topic of the show is about Krakoa. It's about the history of Krakoa. We talk about radioactive monsters and mutant homeland and ancient history and how it becomes modern. It's a beautiful story. I am not going to presume you guys read a lot of X-Men books currently, but Krakoa over the last several years in the comics has become the mutant homeland, and a lot of queer creators and queer storylines. And there's been kind of an emphasis on queerness in the books for a while, which is really lovely. But that just changed last year, about 6 months ago. We're kind of back to the X-Men are split up all over the world now, which is crazy. So this book we're going to read is going to draw heavily upon Giant Size X-Men #1, which is the Len Wein and Dave Cockrum story from 1975. This book was published in 1990. And the premise of this, anytime we're reading a what if comic, is we get the cosmic watcher peering into another reality and, you know, asking some sort of question. The watcher is the most ADHD character. I just picture him like hitting his channel change button all the time, just peering around, looking in people's windows like a big crazy peeping Tom. He's a funny character to me. This is officially Earth designation 105709, which I don't know where that number actually came from. We're reading reading What If Volume 2, Number 9 from January 1990. And Roy Thomas is the writer on this. This is back when Roy was coming back to the books. He was writing Avengers West Coast and a couple of other titles. Rich Buckler on pencils, Sam De La Rosa on inks, Evelyn Stein on colors, Bill Felix on letters, Craig Anderson on edits. Now, did the two of you work with any of this creative team at all during your time in comics?
I worked with Felix and Craig and Tom. I think I might have worked with Rich. I think that's about it.
Yeah.
I think you did work with Rich at some point. Probably my guess would be when you were Terry Cavanaugh's assistant and you were working on Marvel Comics Presents.
Ah, okay.
Because I don't recall Rich doing anything for us on X Factor when I was your assistant.
You know, and I think Sam De La Rosa, I must have had him inking something.
Probably. I didn't work with any of them. I knew Craig Anderson and Tom DeFalco, of course.
Yeah.
The other What If book we're going to be covering in January is basically, what if the original X-Men had defeated Krakoa and the new X-Men had never been recruited? So that's one of the stories. Today, what we're the story we're exploring is, what if the new X-Men had been recruited, but they all died on Krakoa?
GEICO makes it easy to get affordable renter's insurance in as little as 90 seconds. And then you'll start to wonder why everything else isn't so fast. Like, why does it take so long to do the dishes? A meal that's gone in three requires 45 minutes worth of dishes. Doesn't make sense. But it does make sense to get renter's insurance through GEICO. That way, that pile of dirty dishes and the other things you love are covered. Get more with GEICO.
So Giant Size X-Men number one ends with Lorna Dane sending Krakoa off into space. And in this reality, none of the X-Men made it off the island. So they are all dead. And this is a really fun issue that dives deep into continuity. And we get the benefit of a little continuity being added at this point. So since this book is being written in 1990, a bunch more characters have been introduced. A lot of the mythos have been explored. But it's also 1990, which means a lot of what we know now was not known then, right? There's a lot of continuity that has been since added that's not reflected here. So this is a time capsule in its own way. On the cover of this book, we get What If the X-Men Died on Their First Mission. Charles Xavier is being pushed in a wheelchair out of a cemetery by the Beast. And there's a giant wall, like memorial of the X-Men behind them, with a couple characters missing. Poor Lorna Dane just never gets her moment. Everybody's head is carved into stone, except basically Lorna, and maybe Angel's not there. It's Angel, or Xavier is shouting in pain. The X-Men are dead and I killed them. And there's a dark, starry night. In the top left, we get the cover box of the Watcher over the Beast. And I think that's supposed to be Wolfsbane's like child head there, but her hair's painted white, which makes it look more like Quicksilver or baby Magneto. It's what are your thoughts on this cover, Jay?
I think it's a great cover. It's reflective of, I always loved the ones where they would kind of insinuate who died in the X-Men. So like when there would be gravestones, kind of like
it's got a little Days of Future Past energy.
Yep,
for sure.
Yeah. And so I enjoy it.
We open on a very busy title page. I am fascinated by the way different artists draw the Watcher. This is like Professor X if he was like a cosmic space god energy. He's got like big yellow rubber gloves on and like a toga and a skirt, and he's pointing at us. There is a very busy cover of all of the X-Men from Giant Size X-Men number one gathered here as the Watcher basically says, hey, what about a world in which these characters did not survive? And that's where the book opens. Kelly, you were the Watcher for a while during your days as a Marvel editor. Are you a Watcher fan?
No, not at all.
I think he's creepy.
Yeah. He's always looking.
Do you have a favorite costume of these classic characters on the title page here?
I guess Wolverine, but I never liked that Storm costume.
You didn't?
No.
Oh, I like it. I liked it when I appeared in X-Men 97 again, when it made a reappearance.
It's very lingerie-y, but I love it still. Jay, do you have a favorite?
I always liked Angel's costume in that. I didn't like it when he became Archangel and all that other, you know, the metal wings and all that, but I enjoyed Angel's costume, either the blue there or even the red version.
There's a really fun mix of the Silver Age looks with these kind of new 70s looks here, and these characters are very nostalgic, but none of them are in this issue. So a couple of continuity points really quickly for long-term readers. Again, this was made in 1990. New Mutants number 98 didn't come out until 1991, which is the point where James Proudstar, the brother of John Proudstar, becomes Warpath and joins X-Force, and that's a character character that we love, love, love now. But he first appears in New Mutants number 16 in 1984, joins the Hellions, and then goes on a quest to get revenge on Xavier for having killed his brother Thunderbird. So we're going to see James Proudstar in this issue. So he doesn't have a lot of history in the comics at this point.
I think it's Proudfoot.
Well, they call him both in this. It's Proudstar, okay. And then they misprinted as Proudfoot at one point.
Okay.
He just goes along with it. We meet Rain Sinclair along with all the rest of the New Mutants in Marvel graphic novel number 4 in 1982. She's painted to be about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old in this issue, when in reality she's probably closer to 14 or 15, but it's another reality. It's fine. The other characters that we meet here are Teresa Rourke Cassidy, who is Siren, the daughter of Banshee. We first meet her in 1980 in Spider-Woman number 37. The other character we see here is Namorita, who we first meet in 1972 in Submariner number 50. And there's a lot of crazy continuity with Namor being a mutant, but also not a mutant, but also his cousin Namora is also a mutant, and her clone is also her daughter, Namorita, who is a very queer-coded character. And this is the team that gets assembled in this issue. It's a really fun, kind of crazy turnaround, also involving the Avengers continuity, where Scarlet Witch is now married to the Vision, Quicksilver is now married to Crystal and living in Adalan. So a lot going on. Another character Chris Claremont introduces very early on is Moira McTaggart, who at this point is in 1990, like really based in Muir Island, which is the place the X-Men keep going and like having all these misadventures. She's the mother of Proteus, the ex-lover of Charles Xavier. In the comics now, and this is where the continuity gets nuts, in the Krakoan era, and you two may not know this, Moira McTaggart has been revealed to be a mutant who, whenever she dies, her life resets back to the womb, and she has lived a bunch of lifetimes before this. This is recent continuity, just in the last few years. And she approached Xavier before the X-Men ever formed, and he got like a look into her mind at these other realities and lives that she had lived in these worlds full of mutants. So none of that is referenced in this issue, of course, but it's kind of a crazy thing to stack the continuity up when we're looking at these what-ifs. Any thoughts just about that quick editorial overview before we jump into the storyline?
Holy cow.
Does it make you miss your Marvel days where you had to keep track of this shit?
Yeah, some of this, sometimes I feel like I'm glad I'm not there anymore.
That's kind of my sentiment too, because I was, you know, the continuity person back then, and I knew the through line, but now when I hear all this stuff, I'm not so familiar with it, and I don't know how to wrap my head around what's going on in the current issues.
Something weird happened around 2021, where all the continuity started mattering in different ways. The X-Men had been kind of sporadic for a long time, but once that Krakoan era started, like everything's on the table and you got to keep track of it all. It's crazy, but it's fun as an X-Men fan. I don't work on the handbooks anymore, but it fucks with my brain in all the right ways. I really enjoy it. So we open this story in the Scottish Highlands, where Moira McTaggart has received a telegram from the United States from Henry McCoy about an ailing Charles Xavier who's really struggling. And Moira decides that she needs to fly immediately to the United States, where Charles has been running his, quote, well-respected school for gifted children. And as she's going, her young ward, Rain Sinclair, who I love this messy character, she's great, runs up in her little like plaid skirt and orange top with her little fuzzy head. Fucking Reverend Craig is chasing after her. Rain is begging Moira, please, wherever you're off to, take me with you. And the creepy Reverend Craig is yelling, I don't know if I want to try Scottish today, it's going to come out Irish. Don't you be shielding the girl, Moira McTaggart, she's my ward. And it's I who must be chastising her when she rewards my kindness by running off. We've done a Patreon on this fucking character. He's the worst. Go look that up if you want to hear my thoughts on Reverend Craig. He's threatening to beat the child, but Moira convinces him, like, I'll make a donation to your church, but I'm taking Rain with me to America. Somehow I got to sneak her through customs. And off she goes. Jay, do you have thoughts on the Moira-Rain relationship at all?
I always thought it was very sweet, you know, that Moira took her in. And I actually think, you know, when you were doing your version of Reverend Craig, I thought you sounded pretty good. and I thought they did a good job with him in the actually New Mutants movie, with Reverend Craig kind of in her fear of him and haunting her.
As a kid who grew up in like a very religious culty space and like was shamed a lot for my queerness, these two just trigger me all wrong. Rain has all that like Catholic guilt, and he's just like this creepy guy who, you know, it's very Catholic priest in his quiet parish where he like rules the town. I hate this character.
Yeah.
So we jump to a plane. Moira McTaggart and Rain have landed, and they are at 1407 Gray Mall Malkin Lane, a newfound family ready to happen, guys. That's why this show is named Grey Malkin Lane. And Moira says, you know, hey, I'm going to be caring for my friend. Rain, you're going to have to keep yourself entertained. Please, Lady Moira, don't treat me like a wee baby, even though she's like fucking 5 years old here. They answer the door and we get Henry P. McCoy at their service. And he is basically saying, I'm going to carry all your bags in. And they're like, oh, he's so strong. In this world, Moira seems to know nothing about the X-Men, where in our world, she basically helped Xavier put the team together. So there's an interesting through line there as well. And he basically says, you know, Beast says, I've been taking care of Xavier for a long time. Now I need some support. So, you know, I reached out to his old girlfriend. Maybe you can come take care of him while I go back to work. Beast also looks completely normal here. And if you go back to the early 70s, this is when he turned blue and furry, but wore like a latex mask and like some big clothes over all his fur. So this is that era for the Beast where he's pretending to look normal. It's one of the most ridiculous X-Men stories ever. We get specific comments on that in a minute with his latex mask.
I was going to say one of the best portrayals of rubber masking I've ever seen.
Just ridiculous. Kelly, are you a Beast fan?
No. No, and I didn't. That whole mask thing, especially in this book, I was like, did that really happen?
It did. Steve Englehart's story is from the early 70s. Beast in the cartoon, I love him in the animated series, right? Where he's like the very poetic doctor hanging from the ceiling. I love that.
That version I like with the glasses.
Moira is shown in. Hello, Charles. And he says, Moira, what are you of all people doing here? He's very, very upset that Moira is there. I can no longer abide human contact of any kind. Like, don't even touch me. He's deep in his like thick grief era. Beast basically says, look, Moira is going to be your new housekeeper. She's come to take care of you. That is how Chris Claremont initially introduces her in the comics. Now, we of course know that Rain Sinclair is a mutant. She does not know it at the time. Cerebro in this issue is this weird lighty uppy red button device that Xavier's just sitting in front of, and it activates as soon as Rain walks by. But Xavier says, I am not fit for company. He wheels himself away. He's very angry at Beast for trying to help Charles feel better. And then he has to recount his complex history. But first, he's got to pull his latex mask off, showing off his blue fur. And Moira seems to take it very much in stride. This is the thing I hate most about the Beast, is when he uses weird words. So he needs to explain to Moira what's going on. And he says, I fear the only way to explain things, as the professor put it, is to take the male bovine by the bony projections. Woof. Woof.
Oh boy.
It's just rough speech. And in this world, we get the version of what happened on Krakoa for the X-Men.
Well, as I recall, like the original X-Men were captured and Xavier had to find new mutants to go rescue them, sent them to Krakoa. And like you said, ultimately Krakoa is like blasted into space. But the X-Men were rescued in our timeline. And here, it seems that they aren't and they perished.
They went launching into space, which who knows, in this world, maybe they're just living on Krakoa. Like off on some foreign planet somewhere, right? But Xavier has reason to believe they're dead.
He kind of felt their passing as well. I think he mentioned something about their pain. He felt their pain as they, you know, perished.
We get three really dense pages that have a bunch of flashback panels, and they're so wordy. But basically, it recounts the entire script from Giant Size X-Men number one, including the recruiting of all of the characters and the launch of Krakoa into space. Kelly, editorially, when you see this many words on a page, what's your reaction?
I understand now. I was once told that I was the most wordy person when it came to dialogue and putting balloons on pages, but no, I'm not. This person is.
Roy Thomas, the writer, yeah.
Holy cow. I feel for the letterer.
And in this world, Xavier was in mental contact with the X-Men when they died. We get this image of him realizing that they are dead. His mutant mind, quote, had felt each horror, each stabbing pain as a physical wound, now felt 13 young souls swept from the cosmic slate, like scrawled words casually erased from a blackboard. And he collapses. No. Beast was visiting from Avengers Mansion, found Xavier virtually comatose, it says, and he's been kind of taking care of him ever since. This is a sad scene when you watch Xavier's child army get wiped away in this way. But like, it's really hard. It's sad to see him grieve. Jay, are you a Professor X fan?
Yeah, I was always a fan of Professor X. He seems rather cold here, but I understand why. You know, if I felt all of my friends, you know, when they pass their last moments, I think it would be difficult to cope with.
Yeah, so. I do grief work for a living. I'm a trauma therapist. I sit with people in their grief all the time. And there's that period of time where it just has to feel heavy for a while. Now, when you're a telepath, I don't know what this man's doing in people's minds, because Xavier typically is not a very emotionally mature person the way that he handles things in the comics. So we get an image of Moira sitting at the desk. Weeks pass. Moira McTaggart immerses herself in the 1001 tasks of running a household and tries to forget that once, it seems so long ago, she and Charles Xavier had been young and in love. Now, the history is they dated, he went off to war, she Dear Johned him and married Joe McTaggart, which is where Proteus comes from. That's all you need here, but it's more complex when you add the Krakoan era of Moira. A few words pass between the two of them now, and those pitiful few are formal to the point of painfulness. As for Rain, now she's running around the house exploring. She's the Jubilee character or the Kitty Pride character in this issue. She's the little one. She gets to become more acquainted with the Beast. And as he's showing her a giant war room screen, we get direct text from X-Men 94, which is Chris Claremont's first issue of the book, where Count Nefaria has taken over a mountain base in Colorado, and he's threatening to deploy the nuclear missiles from this place against all the countries of the world. He's also mutated some old Daredevil villains, the Animen, who are now Animal Men, working for him, and added a new one, a very queer character named Dragonfly, who I fucking love. She's a great character. They are now working for him, and they've taken over the base. And in this world, the X-Men are not there to save them. Do you guys remember this original storyline, Count Nefaria and the Animen from the old Claremont books?
Nope.
I feel like this is when Thunderbird died, actually, wasn't it?
Yes, this is the story where at the end, Thunderbird refuses to listen to Cyclops, climbs aboard the escaping plane, and it blows up and he's killed.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay.
We're going to be doing live script readings of these stories this year on my show. So if you enjoy a good radio hour, feel free to tune in. We'll be doing X-Men 94 at the start of February. And we're opening the show in January with a reading of Jaya Size number one, which is really fun. So Beast is like, holy shit, this man's going to destroy the world. He calls Jarvis, and Jarvis is like, dude, the Avengers are gone. And Beast's like, oh no, we've got to find some new X-Men then. Xavier says, no, I sent people to their deaths. I won't convince anyone else. Whether the world saves itself or gets incinerated, I can have no part in it. So he wheels himself out of the room, and it's now up to Beast to be the new Xavier. Now, Cerebro is a machine that allows telepaths to interface on a mechanical level with the astral plane in some way and identify mutant minds around the world. It's always weird to me when we see non-telepathic characters using Cerebro, but Forge, you know, maybe he upgraded it a little bit. We have the ability for Kitty Pryde or Beast to put the helmet on.
I just couldn't understand how he could know how to use it, even.
Maybe Xavier, as he wheeled himself away, just downloaded the info into Beast's brain.
Could be. But that was one of the first times I've ever seen Cerebro being used by someone who wasn't.
The first person he reaches out to is Wanda Maximoff.
Well, let's see. It looks like she's hanging out at some beach.
They're on their honeymoon in Polynesia.
Yeah. And then she all of a sudden gets in costume. Gotta go. And they don't explain it here, but I guess he can't go with her because he's not human.
Well, because he's not mutant, I think, more so.
A mutant? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
She's married to a synthezoid, and she knows that this is a mission for mutants. It cracks me up, though, when she initially gets Beast's summons, she's like, oh, I've got a headache. And Vision just goes off to go swimming. And when he comes back, he's like, I couldn't concentrate on my backstroke. And she's in her full costume ready to go. The Vision doing the backstroke is really delightful to me for some reason. We then jump to Quicksilver on the moon.
Quicksilver's with Crystal, I assume, on the dark side of the moon, and he gets the summons as well and pretty much says, well, if the world didn't include you, and I think they have a child at this point.
I don't think Luna is born just yet. But okay. Quicksilver goes, you and Wanda weren't in danger. I wouldn't even go. Otherwise, the entire planet could roast for all I care. Fuck this guy.
Right. So that's the only reason, his only motivation to go out and help.
We then jump to Beast decides to scan for the Submariner, but reaches out to Namorita instead. And she's just hanging out, having a normal day in her green bikini under the water. She has harnessed a strap to a sea turtle named Churchy. And she's just riding around. And she goes, whoa, Churchy, I'm getting some mental MTV from somebody or other. Galloping Galapagos. The whole world's in danger? And she's like, Namor's off in the Marianas Trench, but a little Nita can give you a hand. Just beam me Yeah, I love Namorita, actually. I especially, she gives me like real, like, what's the redheaded actress's name? Anne Margaret vibes from like Bye Bye Birdie. That's always how I hear like Namorita in my brain, especially in the early 70s. She gives off like real queer vibes to me. I love her. Then the machine starts to give off some sound effects. It's giving mms and zzzz. Beast is like, okay, Rain, I think you're activating this. He realizes she might be a mutant. But then he jumps all the way around the world with his mind to Ireland. And Kelly, who do we find here?
Well, this is probably my favorite panel of the entire comic, because we're looking at this, which we assume is Banshee Man, and it's not a man.
Teresa is in Banshee's costume, bow-legged and screaming with a shroom.
I really want to see the plot, the actual plot that was written, saying, telling the artist to please draw Banshee, but make it so that you really can't tell if it's a man or a woman, and do it from behind.
And she's got the deepest V cut, like it's all the way down to her navel, like half her tits are out. So he reaches out to Teresa Cassidy. Now, Teresa, I'll cover this very quickly. Again, her origins hadn't been fleshed out a lot here. Banshee never knew he had a daughter because his wife died. He has a gay cousin named Black Tom who has a husband named Juggernaut. None of that's canon, but that's how we phrase it on this show. And Black Tom secretly raised Teresa in like a boarding school and like made her a criminal before she ever learned that Sean is her dad. So we see Black Tom like training Teresa here, and he's like teaching how to use her powers. And then when she hears Beast in her brain, Black Tom's like, no, you're mine. Like, go lie down for a little while, Teresa. Like, don't listen to that man in your brain. I don't know if you guys have thoughts on the Black Tom Teresa dynamic. I think it's a really interesting, because he's the queer uncle raising the daughter. Any thoughts?
I never realized that Black Tom had a queer slant to him.
Yeah, all of Black Tom and Juggernaut's stories are like the two of them are like boyfriends doing crimes together. And then in fact, in your era on the books, Black Tom gets really sick and like starts to turn into plant matter. And there's a bunch of stories about Juggernaut, like, pay attention to my husband, he's dying. And it's like very AIDS crisis stories written by Nicieza through the early 90s. It's actually quite tragic when you read it as a queer relationship. The two of them met in prison and then stayed together. So Beast is crying out because the Cerebro machine keeps acting up. But we get one last recruitment, and this is James Proudstar. Jay, do you want to tell us about this scene? Or James Proudfoot, as it labels. The editor did not catch the mistake.
So essentially, he's just creating a memorial for his brother, who passed away when they went to save the X-Men. And his only knowledge of the X-Men is the letter that his brother left saying, I'm off to help the X-Men. So he's very dubious of who the X-Men are and who Charles Xavier is.
Beast's recruitment of James Proudstar, and this is a reference, by the way, to a Claremont story from classic X-Men, where we see James laying his brother to rest. But Beast's recruitment speech, he's in James's mind. James, not much time. Your brother died using his hidden powers for the good of all men. Will you come with me and do the same? It's implying like he thinks James is gonna die. Your brother died. Will you come and do the same? Your power is so much like his, and they're needed. I'll come with you. And when this is all over, I want to meet this Charles Xavier. And if you remember, James was initially very anti-Xavier back in his early, like, New Mutants era. I think it's Uncanny X-Men 192, where he, like, really attacks Xavier and is, like, gonna kill him, but chooses, like, the path of good. We then get Cerebro, like, frequently acting out, and it's very porny, because the letters here to describe Cerebro are just, from panel to panel. It's just lots of that.
I'm thinking of it more of a like a machine.
I think it's funnier if it's a sassy
Well, definitely.
And then it explodes with a frothoom, and Beast somehow, and again, this has to be like a Forge upgrade. It makes no sense. Beast somehow activates Nightcrawler's power, which has been stored in the Cerebro database, and uses that to teleport everyone he's in mental contact with. And they all go to Colorado together to fight Count Nefaria, but only mutants can go. So the Vision gets left behind, as does Crystal. So we've got a team of ad hoc X-Men. It's Beast, Scarlet Witch, Quicksilver, Namorita, James Proudstar, Teresa Rourke, and little baby Rain goes. And she's like, what does that mean? I'm a mutant too. And of course it does, Rain. We knew all along. What are your thoughts on this gathering? This is a fun group.
Totally random to me. Like,
Namorita's here. That's crazy.
Yeah. And back then I didn't even think she would have been a mutant, but.
Well, this is when John Byrne is writing Namor, that title where like Namor becomes like the eco-friendly, you know, Oracle guy. And he's very clearly stated to be a mutant there, which technically makes Namorita one too.
Well, it's interesting there's more women than men.
Yeah, I was going to point out that dynamic with Beast as the leader.
Yeah.
Fun power sets, though. And then again, we get Little Rain, who looks, I don't know, in some of these panels, she looks like she's like 4 or 3 years old. It's crazy.
Yeah, really.
So Teresa chooses to take the name of her father, Banshee, and James agrees to take the name of his brother, Thunderbird. And they're all pulled together. Wanda uses her powers to zap open the mountain base, and we are fully in action here. And I really love this issue. It's a really fun, lots of good character moments, and lots of wonky plots. But they are running into the base, and they are immediately attacked by the Animen. Now, Matt Horak and I have an Animen episode out there. We also talked about them in Giant Size, but we get Ape Man, Bird Man, Cat Man, Frog Man, and Dragonfly. Jay, this one's for you specifically. Fuck, marry, kill Bird Man, Cat Man, and Ape Man. I mean, you can go by name alone or by costume.
Well, you'd marry the Ape Man because he's super strong and can handle any, you know, anything that you need moved or taken care of. I'd probably fuck the Cat Man and kill the Frog Man.
I think the Bird Man was your third option. I knew you'd kill Frog Man. I left him off.
Oh, okay. So I'd kill the Birdman and marry the... and fuck the Catman.
So we get lots of fun little action scenes. There's a lot of moments that stand out. Ape Man is grabbing like James by the head. James's costume here basically is a headband and a loincloth, by the way. He's very shirtless through this whole issue, which I always find Warpath really hot, actually. Kelly, do you have thoughts on his costume?
Well, I would like to marry him.
Yeah, he's yummy. We get Teresa using her sonic scream. We get moments where there's a little few, like James gets a few introspective moments about like, I have to kill Xavier later. You know, I'm going to work with the X-Men now, but I got to go back and get them. And then the most uncomfortable panel of the whole book is on page 19. The last panel, we see Catman and Frogman both jumping at the Scarlet Witch. Catman says, wait till these claws tear into you, witchy. And Frogman says, me and Catman will cream you between us. Woof. That is not okay verbiage in today's day and age. It just sounds so gross. some dialogue doesn't hold up as well as others. I love Dragonfly. We get lots of like elongated S's. Fools, must Dragonfly do everything for herself? And I just want Eartha Kitt to read her. Like that's what will totally live in my brain. And they're like, dude, you're gonna blow up the whole fucking world if you're not careful. Namorita kicks Birdman out of the sky. Beast is really shocked to learn that the Animen are not in costumes. They're actually mutated animals. And Count Nefaria, who is a big asshole, has turned them into animals and won't turn them back unless they work for him. And then we get Dragonfly, who has this power to like hypnotize people. She starts making eye contact with them all. And all of them are, in her words, hopelessly mesmerized. And from far away, Xavier realizes, holy shit, the X-Men are failing and they're all gonna die. Xavier realizes, holy shit, I should have, like, I've been not acting. I haven't been helping them. I could have stopped them all from being hypnotized, but now it's too late. And he's able to mentally somehow turn off the countdown for the nuclear devices from far away, which, good for him. He has a weird influence with machines sometimes. And then the only way to save the team, there's only one mutant left, but his powers haven't even activated yet. So let's activate the mutant gene in the, like, 7-year-old child from the other room. Sorry, Moira, I have no choice. What are your thoughts on this? I hate it when Xavier's like interfering with children. It always bothers me.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought mutant powers came through puberty.
Mm-hmm. Through puberty. But he kind of says that he's going to activate it early.
I know, that seems really creepy.
Yeah. And somehow she looks like a full-grown wolf when she's mutated.
Yeah.
She should be a little puppy.
Transforms.
So he makes Rain open her mind to him. He activates her mutant gene, turns her into a wolf, and then she's able to jump on Dragonfly's back, which frees the X-Men from mental control. But Xavier had already turned off the countdown. Like, he already saved the day. And now the X-Men are like, wait, that's Rain. That's our friend. And they're able to turn the fight against the Animen and win. Did you have thoughts on this scene, Kelly?
Well, if Xavier could have done that, then this whole comic is irrelevant. Why didn't he just do that in the beginning?
Yeah, this is, well, because he was sad and he didn't want to act. He wheeled himself and said, I'm not going to do anything.
Well, if I know anything about grief, which I do, you know, come on, you got to act.
I almost wonder if, like, they realized, oh, we never deactivated the nuclear weapons. So they had to go back and, like, in a speech bubble, be like, oh, yeah, Xavier shut that down. And then that's...
Right.
because we have to get it. Now, this is following the track of the original story in a lot of ways, because Count Nefaria goes to escape, and they could just let him go and go after him later. But that's in the original story where Thunderbird jumps on the ship, punches it, and it explodes. He dies. Count Nefaria survives. In this world, it goes a little bit differently. Nefaria is flying away. Teresa flies after it, hits the ship with a sonic scream, but then when it explodes, she's caught in the shrapnel, and she's going to fall to her death.
All right.
James runs toward the edge of the hill and catches her, and it takes everyone a minute to realize that they are okay. Now, this is funny because in the X-Force comics that will come later, Fabian Nicieza will write these two as a romantic couple for a period of time, but this is before they ever got together during their X-Force era. In fact, this is an era where a lot of readers didn't really even know who Teresa was, because she doesn't become popular until the X-Force book in the following year, which is interesting. So Xavier manifests in the sky above everybody. Wonderful. Yet I see now something I'd forgotten, that there are often risks which must be taken for the greater good. And Namorita goes, who's that making like the Wizard of Oz? I'm Professor Charles Xavier. Right now, you have the world's thanks for what you've done today as a team. I hope Hank and I can persuade you to remain together as the new X-Men. And Quicksilver's like, dude, I'm married. And Wanda's like, yeah, I'm in the Avengers. Like, we're out of here. Give us a call sometime. But the others agree to stay. Namorita's gonna live for Namor's legacy. Rain's like, as long as I get to be part of the team too. And they're like, sure, even though you're five. Banshee and Thunderbird agree. Thunderbird gives Xavier like forgiveness at the end. Now I see that John chose to risk his life, just like Teresa did when she went after Nefaria. I'd be proud to be an X-Man. And Xavier still wants me after hearing what I've just said. I've been blaming him for all this time. Xavier's tired voice fades from their brains. And now the new X-Men are going to live up to the legacy of the old X-Men. We close on Moira McTaggart. Everyone gets overwhelmed by circumstances sometimes. What matters is that eventually we pull ourselves together and start over. You were so busy being a mutant, Charles, that you didn't know you could be a mutant and human as well. She takes his hand, pushes him away in his wheelchair. If you don't mind, Moira, could you wheel me into the computer room? With any luck, I can have Cerebro halfway rebuilt by the time the X-Men get back. And we close on a beautiful group shot of the new team with the creepy watcher looking over them. Often the seeds of victory in one universe breed defeat in another. And so my ancient eyes are accustomed to witnessing at least as many tragedies as triumphs, but not this time. For no matter which or where the world, it seems there will always be X-Men and X-Factor and New Mutants and Excalibur ... which is another really fun editorial commentary at the very end.
Yeah. I was overwhelmed too. That was probably a precursor. What year did this come out?
1990.
Yeah, so then, oh boy, it really blew up after that.
We also get this final shot of the new team. There's Beast, Wolfsbane in a new little cute costume. James has put on a Thunderbird uniform. Namorita and Banshee in the air. Jay, did you have thoughts on this light up? I think it's delightful.
I think so too. And although I'm a little disturbed by how young, it's almost like young Ileana being with the group and going on adventures. I had issues with that too.
She looks like she's 4 years old in this. I know. She's a little 4-year-old wolf girl just going off into the team. So there's another universe out there where this became the new team. Krakoa story is off in space somewhere, and now we have these new mutants activated. I want to read more of these characters, actually. I think it's really fun.
I just have a question. Why does she have such a bad haircut?
Rain has always had that haircut, and I fucking love her for it.
Well, they established it that her hair wouldn't grow.
Later, she gets lots of like eras. She had like a hot teacher era. She has like a pregnant era.
But when she was originally part of the New Mutants, she said that she couldn't grow her hair. Like that is just stuck at that short hairstyle.
Rain is
always jealous of all the other.
Rain is one of those characters I'm very fond of. Rain and Cannonball and Danny. God, I love the New Mutants.
In X Factor, when we had Rain and Moira, we would have lots of dialogue, and we ended up picking up "Idina Ken."
Yeah,
we used to say it all the time in the office.
Yeah. "Idina Ken." We talked about dialect on my show recently, and I'm like, the one that bothers me most with Moira is when they write the word "your" as Y-U-I-R. You're like, that one really bugs me phonetically. Any memories that show up as we're just revisiting an old delightful X-Men comic?
I always liked Moira.
Yeah, I had heard about Moira's reincarnations and all that recently. I never read the issues, but I had heard about them, and
it's pretty good. It's a good story, actually.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to find out she was a mutant and would be reborn every time she died, and but remember each past. So I thought
and she goes real evil in that story. It's pretty intense.
It has something to do with destiny too, right? Doesn't she? Like,
yes.
The Destiny's writings or something like that.
Yeah, well, there's one of Moira's previous lives. Destiny is unable to sense Moira. And there's a storyline where Destiny and Mystique hunt Moira down and like have Pyro burn her to death. So Moira in her future lives is like really avoiding Destiny. But this is the story that brings Destiny back into the comics. And now she and Mystique are legally married. It's really cute.
Aww. And is Mystique actually Nightcrawler's father then? Is that what they established?
Yep. So that's also been established that Destiny is Nightcrawler's birth mother and Mystique is Nightcrawler's birth father slash mother. Like she grew a penis and they had sex and it resulted in a child. Yeah, that's canon now.
So bringing it back to X-Men Unlimited, Kelly and I worked on the issue that established where
Mystique throws Nightcrawler off the waterfall.
Yeah, and that was a Richard Bennett and Scott Lobdell issue. But that was established in one of the books that we edited.
I last April in Portland, I got to go to an X-Men drag night and my friend Dax Exclamation Point painted herself blue and did a full lip sync number where she has a baby Nightcrawler and she's singing about a baby, and then in the middle of the song she just chucks the baby off the stage and like starts dancing as an independent woman. It's fucking great.
Oh, that's great.
It's amazing.
Now, had either of you read this issue before?
No.
First time for both of you. It's fun to visit a little What If universe, and it's mostly delightful just to hang with the two of you and hear your stories. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'd love to hear any final thoughts that you have, if you have them. And as we're wrapping up, where can people find you both online? Is there anything you want to plug for your own stories, your own interests? Let's go Kelly and then Jay.
Well, you can find me mainly on Facebook, Kelly Corvese, C-O-R-V-E-S-E. I'm probably the only one there that exists.
Yeah, actually, I have a fairly ordinary life as well. And I actually don't do social media, so you're not going to find me anywhere.
I hope to hang out again. It's delightful to see you both. Let's stay in touch. Let's text back and forth. I would be thrilled to be your friends and to hang out next time I'm out east. Follow the show, GrahamAlkin_Lane on Instagram. Like, thank you, everybody, so much for listening. Thank you to Kelly and Jay for coming on the show. What an honor. We will see you all back here next time on the Graham Alkin Lane Show. Thank you for listening to Graham Alkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Graham Alkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Graham Alkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Graham Alkin Lane.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.